Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this session of the Computer Users Committee. My name is Louise O'Neill. I'm the new chair of the steering committee for the Computer Users Committee, so it's a pleasure to be here, although I'm no stranger. I've been on the steering committee, and I've even made some presentations here. But it's my pleasure to be here today to introduce our speaker for today, Professor Renee Seaburn, and I first met Renee when she became, we had conversations about a digitization project that we're involved in at the library. I'm also the Associate Director of Library Technology Services, and this was the Ming Qing Women's Writing Project, and it involved Renee using web ontology language to add geographic information to the product. And I had learned about web ontology languages in an XML course I was taking. It was the first time I'd met someone who was actually using them, so I got very excited and very interested in this. So Renee's going to tell us a bit more about computational ontologies today. But just by way of introduction, she is a professor in the Department of Geography and also the School of Environmental Science. And I asked her if it was okay to mention this. There's a wonderful article about Renee in the McGill Reporter, November 2007 issue, but she mentions that she does know Craig Newmark, better known as the founder of Craigslist, so I thought that was a very interesting, something that this crowd would relate to. So I mentioned that. Anyway, without further ado, because time is short, let me turn it over to Renee, and thank you for coming.
So hi, everybody. Where are all you from? You're from? Okay.
I live in Woodside.
Cool.
ISR.
Yeah.
Economics.
Yeah.
Human resources, the IT.
ICS.
Engineering.
Information studies.
Okay. Cool. I'm going to try and this will be more on the underpinnings for how one. Hi, David. How one sets up on, hi Pauline, how one sets up ontologies. So I will minimize some of the discussion about the pure computational aspect because I don't know how many people want to hear me talk about OWL or OWL Protege or RDF, but I can if people want me to talk about some of that. So I'm going to give you some background on what the heck ontologies are, and then I'm going to give you one or two applications that I've researched, two if we have the time, and last I'll talk about just a few technical considerations and social challenges in using computational or conceptual ontologies. Okay. What are these things? Well, you probably, if you haven't been computational or you're in IS or you're in library science, well, that probably captures a lot of you here. Philosophers say it's the essence of being. So it's the nature of being. It's what we are what we know. And what we know, according to many philosophers, can be categorical. So it can be universal or particular. It could be abstract or concrete. So if philosophers started to look at the question of what is being, they discovered or they hypothesized that humans are very categorical creatures, like we like to separate things into nice little boxes and relate the boxes together. Well, along came information science, computer science, and AI, and they loved the idea of ontologies, and they thought that it'd be very useful for the ability to reuse software components. So they decided to call, to appropriate the concept of ontology and call it an explicit specification of a conceptualization. And what that simply means is, in computer science, in IS, in AI, can we formalize the concepts that we use? We formalize them and computerize them. And why is this even more important? Because this has become the backbone of Web 3.0. Now, probably some of you have just discovered there's a Web 2.0. Some of you didn't even know there were Web 1, 2s, and 3s. But there is indeed a Web 3.0. So the Web 1.0 has been the static presentation and dissemination of information on the web. Web 2.0 has been all of the Facebooking and all of the dynamic websites and all of the user-generated content and all of the sharing of content that has gone on. So social networking, so being able to tag content so that it can be shared independent of its original platform. So used to be on a blog, but then you can now dig that post on the blog and put it into Facebook. You can mash things up. So you can take little slivers of code and embed them in other applications. And voila, you've got a program within a program. So the archetypal one or two of them is YouTube videos that you can embed in other applications and Google Maps mashups. But the next holy grail for the web is Web 3.0, and that is the semantic web. That is the ability to ask natural language queries, and the computer just knows, the cloud just knows what you mean when you use certain words. One of the examples, and it can distinguish amongst the words and the word phrases as well. So it can, biology is using Web 3.0 a lot, and their standard example is, can you understand the difference between the hepatitis virus and viral hepatitis? Two different things, but the words are almost identical. So the cloud, the servers, have to have this understanding to be able to get you the information you want. So that is the essence of Web 3.0, and to do that, you need ontologies. You need these explicit specifications of concepts. So, computationally, what exactly is an ontology? It is very, very similar to things you might already use, catalogs in libraries, metadata. It is metadata and catalogs are controlled and standardized and structured vocabularies. So only certain words are allowed to categorize a particular concept. Of course, once again, back to Web 3.0, the goal is to expand that vocabulary to the entire dictionary. It is computationally a set of entities, attributes, and axioms plus relations. So it is a set of entities, concepts, and I work a lot, well, my first project in this was with hydrology and hydrography, so geography and hydrology. So we had concepts like river, riverbed, riverbank, water in the river, all concepts. These concepts can have attributes. They can have properties, characteristics. So a riverbed may have a certain kind of sandy loam in the bottom. I just met someone yesterday who's working with expired rivers that were right next to sawmills. So she said, our riverbeds have sawdust in them, like a meter's worth of sawdust in it. So, you know, whatever's on the riverbed becomes the attribute. Axioms, rules. So there may be rules of if it's water in the river, how fast the water flows. What characteristic the river has, temperature, opacity, transparency, plus the relations. So what relationship is a river to a water body? Probably is a type of a water body. What relationship is a river bank to a river? Well, it's near, it's adjacent. So you establish these relationships. And that's why an ontology technically is more than a controlled, standardized, and structured vocabulary, because it has these attributes, axioms, and relations. So it's more than just a word list. So, bubbling up from this, it's the concepts and the connections behind the data. So we've got all this data out there. We're talking about, you know, terabytes, petabytes of information out there. How does one extract the core concepts out of these data sets, out of domains of knowledge, and then employ these as standardized templates so that we can connect 1 terabyte of information to 1 petabyte of information. And we get the answers to those natural language queries. So ontologies at the conceptual stage, when you're designing them, because sometimes you design them from the bottom up and sometimes you have to apply them after you have the data, look pretty much like this. So you get a lot of concepts, and it's also somewhat different from a dictionary, because what you're trying to do is you're trying to reach behind the lexical to the core meaning of something, and that's how you connect one data set to another. You find out where is the river in this particular data set. So, for example, you have the concepts. A channel is part of a stream. A bank is part of a channel. A bed is part of a channel. You have the attributes of those entities, right? So a bed could have a shape. It could have various kinds of materials. It could have vegetation. And you can have the connections, the relations between them. And these are very simple relations. Is a type of, is part of. And in a bit, I'll show you some more complex relations you can have amongst concepts. So why ontologies? I talked a little bit about some of the reasons. I talked about Web 3.0. Because ontologies provide the semantics and the shared understanding of information. So if you have a geologist who wants to talk to an urban planner, for example, you probably should have the same understanding or be able to connect what a cadastre is, what a land parcel is. If you've got some sense of, and this is a classic problem in urban planning, and I choose the cadastre, the land parcel, as one of the primary examples. I did, my PhD was actually in urban planning. Holla to urban planning out there. And I interned in a city manager's office in which they had 40 different definitions of a land parcel. Well, there are historical reasons why you have different definitions. So you don't necessarily want to remove them and standardize all of them, but you need to understand them. And the only way that you can connect across these concepts is if you can build these ontologies. You can have some elements in which you share understanding, and then you have extensions of those. So, as consequently, ontologies can provide the technical interoperability of hardware, software, and data, some amount of machine readability, because it's one thing to have a data set, it's one thing to have a conversation or a research, that you're conducting research, you have a body of knowledge about the research, it's another thing to make that machine readable. And you can get a sense, I showed you that for the guys who just came in, I showed you this beforehand, the standard way that one shows a conceptual ontology of concepts, relations, attributes of those concepts. It's quite another thing to make that computational. And starting with the conceptual base is the first place that you start to make it computational, because you can see, aha, now I've got the river bed category. I can figure out how I'm going to turn that into something using OWL and RDF, for example. Then you can make it searchable. You can have some reasoning capacity, some computational reasoning capacity. I want to know all of the land parcels that are near the river. You may have some understanding of what the river is, the land parcels are, and what near means. Near, of course, can be culturally or legally descriptive and distinct from each other. They should ideally enhance data quality. You're essentially building superstructure on top of the data that you have. Enable access, greater access, because you have that searchability now, and persist over time. So you can add, like you can with the web now, there's a sense of persistence. The data is there, it's not necessarily going to go away, although probably many of us know about the Memory Hole project, that a lot of data does go away on the internet. But the ideal is that we have data archived over time and we can access the concepts over time. And if the concepts change over time, our ontology should be flexible to handle the changes in the concepts. So to manage large quantities of data as well as legacy data, and to maintain some control over your data set while allowing the access. One of the things I'm really interested in my research is the ability for ontologies to support missing, conflicting, and contested knowledge. I'm going to show you one and maybe two projects. One's working with an indigenous community in the lower James Bay, and the other is working with Chinese historical, biographic, and geographic databases. Believe me, they're connected because they're both about ontology research and both about geography research. I thought, oh gosh, you know, with indigenous people, there's, you know, well-documented literature of contested knowledge and contested views of the landscape and ecology, but, you know, Chinese historical scholars, humanities scholars, no, there's not going to be much in terms of contested knowledge. I was wrong, right? So, yes, it's been an interesting challenge working with computational ontologies in the humanities if for no other reason that there is a lot of disagreement about what concepts mean. So, I showed you the concept map. Another way to show concepts maps is this it's right here. Okay, so that's your starting point. It's another way to show it as a tabular form. To get to the computational stage, you have to go through these various stages. So you need to formalize it logically. So this links to this. This is a part of this. This is a type of this. This feeds into this. Then you need to computerize it. And that's a screenshot of Owl Protege. Finally, you need to deploy it. And I'm showing you here a database schema. And it looks very much like, for those of you who know entity relation models or know UML, looks very much like that. So I'm going to take you through one example, and hopefully for those of you I've lost sometime in the distant past, like slide 2 or something, that maybe you'll be able to get somewhat of a better understanding of what these ontologies are, they do for you, and maybe some of the challenges, and also a bit of the computation as well. So this is application 1. This is understanding and integrating ecological knowledge of the Cree. There's a team of us working in Wiminji, Quebec. It's about 18-hour drive from here. It's on the lower James Bay. The team is about 17 people. It's headed by Colin Scott in anthropology, and it has philosophers and natural resource people and geographers and I think that's about it for the domains of knowledge, and a lot of support by the Cree people in Wiminji. And our project was to integrate the knowledge through conceptual and computational ontologies. So here is where Wiminji is. It's a village. It has about 1,200 people in it. It's in the lower James Bay there. Now where's Montreal? Somewhere down here somewhere? They work off a traditional land tenure system. The white lines you vaguely see there, I hope you're seeing it in the camera, are what are called trap lines. And those are managed by traditional hunting bosses called tallymen. And they control who's allowed to trap in those areas, who's allowed to hunt and fish and extract in those areas. 25% of the people live purely off the land. About half of the people spend a good portion of the year in the bush. This is a community that is also sufficiently far away from the James Bay projects that they haven't been too affected by the fallout, particularly the cultural fallout from the James Bay projects. Although it's very interesting to see the 21st century version of potential fallout, which is enormous interest in mineral exploration that's happening because of climate change and the warming up of these environments. We've documented a fair bit of outcomes of climate change already as the vegetation and the wildlife are shifting their habitats. So even fairly far south as this is, there we can watch climate change on the ground. This is, I have this black and white photograph because it's a nice illustration of the old meets the new. So while you have a traditional walking out ceremony for a little girl, you still have someone in the background videotaping it. Right? So it's important to realize that these aren't communities fixed in time, but they move with the time as well. They have their own geographic information systems, projects up there, so they're doing computerized mapping. They have fairly sophisticated telecommunications, high bandwidth, courtesy of the nearby James Bay projects. But it is, of course, a struggle for the old to meet the new. And one of the things we were looking at is ways to integrate their concepts of the land into the official ways of understanding the land. So we worked with their concepts of hydrography. That's why I showed you the diagram of water. And one way to illustrate why we might be interested in this is for, don't know how many of you besides David out there who understands geographic information systems. So this is ways to manage, analyze, and visualize geospatial information. Google Earth, Google Maps being the latest incarnation, but it's fairly limited in what that suite of software applications can do. The geographic information systems actually has more in it in terms of analytic capacity. So here's a typical data set for GIS. It's got streams. It has streams of varying widths. There are some rapids in the streams. In an official view of this data set, which slices the world up into layers, so you have the hydrology layer. The hydrology layer has streams in it. That's what the concept of the hydrology is. It's water bodies. For the Cree, who view water as a means of transportation, certain times of the year it's the best means of transportation, and in some parts of their territory it's the only means of transportation. They do consider streams to be water, but where there are rapids, and there are many places on these streams where there are rapids, the portage areas along the rapids are considered to be part of the streams. So, just because it is not neat and tidy in an official data set that would want to separate the streams from the land, do we ignore that connection between the portage around the rapids and the section of the stream that is the rapids? We would argue no. Why should we follow, why should every culture follow one culture's way of describing streams? This is not just an indigenous versus white or dominant society issue. There was a project that tried to integrate, well, still trying to integrate geospatial data sets in the European Union. And one of the big problem areas is water bodies. In Spanish, English, and French, there are different definitions of the spatial extent of a lake. Does the lake include just the water? Is it the water at its lowest point in the lake, right? So a very dry spell that constitutes the lake. The very wettest spell is the lake. Does it include the banks of the lake? Part of the stream that feeds into the lakes? These are all complications to integrating these data sets, and it's one reason why the European Union is looking in a big way to using computational ontologies to try and figure out a way around this. So maybe we can distill a universal water body, and for the French version, we have a little bit of this. And for the German version, we have a little less of this. But for us, it's just portages and other little things at the moment. So how does one start with ontologies? Well, one often starts, even though I told you it was not a dictionary, one often starts with dictionaries. There are dictionaries of Cree online. So you'd look at various words in the dictionary. We compiled a list. There's CB, and that is defined in this dictionary as river. And then we went out into the community. We said, here's our list of words for river. Do they have all the things that you use to describe water bodies? If not, what other things do you use to describe water bodies? What things are connected to these water bodies? So begins this long process of collecting these concepts, the attributes of these concepts, and the relations between these concepts. This is the first part of our conceptual ontology. So you remember that little table down there in the previous slide? This is the larger version. So we have the Cree terms, which don't necessarily show up in the official Quebec terms or the official federal terms, since some parts of this particular community are provincial, some are federal, some are contested Inuit territories. So we've got a lot of legislation and jurisdictional issues in this particular community. So you have a sense now of the concepts we're building. So we're trying to get at these core concepts, like maybe channel is a core concept. Maybe shibastic, I think I got that right, is the core concept. We have shibish here. Maybe we use that as a core concept. Maybe we use the creek as a core concept. We separate a stream from a core concept, and we link them together, and an instance of that becomes shibish. You also get a sense of the relations of these particular terms, or maybe the concepts embedded in the terms. So if it feeds from a waterway, you imagine that concept diagram again, you'd have a shibastic, and that would be connected via a line that, say, feeds from to maybe a superordinate class, from those of you who are slightly more computational, that would be waterway. Connected, empties, feeds from. Some of these are the other side of a reciprocal relationship. The arrows can be two-way, and they can have slightly different relationships on either side. Although one simple way would be to think of it as feeds into, feeds from. So this gives you a sense of a diagrammatic way to think of a table that you just saw. One of the interesting challenges we had is that we found that the Cree often had concepts that were in pairs. and they had concepts that were diminutives of others. So you would have big brother lakes and little brother lakes. Should we throw that concept out because it doesn't show up in the Quebec Ministry of Environment's concepts of hydrology? We'd argue no. Why not model that? We've got the computational abilities. We have the conceptual abilities. They certainly do. We can model it, and we can see how it relates to the official ontology or concept list of a government agency. This is another challenge for those of you who are fairly computational. Ontologies exist as classes. And when you look at a specific river or a specific part of a river, you call it an instance, right? So an expression of the class is the instance. So you may have a concept called bay, and a specific instance of that is the James Bay. Another one is the Hudson's Bay. Technically, in ontologies, the relationships only occur at the conceptual level, this more universal, this more standardized level. And the instances are expressions of all the relationships above that that are connected via these dotted or hard lines to it. What we were finding was that there were unique relations between the instances as well, not just between the classes. And we have hypothesized that that's because in trap lines, where you know your area the best, there may be only one instance of something. So the concept is essentially the same as the instance. But the thing is that the relationships you therefore have of that stream or that lake may be slightly different from someone in the very next trap line. And the Cree, I don't know if we could generalize to other communities, but they're very reticent to hypothesize or speculate about any other trap lines. Right? They'll tell you about their own, but they're not going to say, yes, I know how they think of, I know how they conceptualize what a lake is over there. So as I mentioned, Crees, at least in this community, often name things in pairs. And here's an example of paired lakes. And one is often the diminutive of the other. And you'll see that in the actual lexicon, that there will be a suffix that will describe that it's an actual diminutive of another. I talked about these relationships at the instance level, not just at the class level. We have a certain number of kind of odd lakes, too, that we didn't know what to do with, like zigzag lakes. Is a zigzag lake computationally, is a zigzag an attribute of a class of lake? Or should that be a concept in and of itself? So conceptually, you can be a bit more vague. But the more computational you become, the more rigid you have to become in how you designate these things. One of the challenges we found is that there were no superclasses. When you create an ontology, whether it's biology or hydrography here or Earth observational data, and biology and Earth observational data have some of the biggest ontologies out there, you want to have the superclasses, right? The ones that stand at the very top from which all categories derive. For us, it'd be water body or water course, right? We can distill that. But the Cree that we talked to had no concept for water course that linked all of the water bodies together. So a challenge for us was, do we invent this concept for them, even though they don't express it to us when they talk to us? So it's not merely a matter of they don't have a word for it, is they don't seem to have a concept for it either. So do we invent it because it is an easier match to the official government ontologies? Do we invent it because we think, well, even though they're not expressing it, they probably have some way that we have yet to be able to elicit that describes and clumps them all together? Maybe a covert class. And like language in general, there were generational differences in concepts and in relations. And that is not so easy to handle the farther down the path you go for ontologies. The more computational you make it, the more difficult it is to start to add new things in, because it's more and more and more and more work. It's easier just to sort of set it in stone. Here it is, the end. I'm on to my next project. But there were significant differences from the elders to the young. So I want to give you a sense of some of these different relations from the pure physiographic relations I showed before. So yes, an earthen point on a niatch could be connected to a water body, and it is earthy in the physiographic sense, but also has a middle-aged speaker. So that concept doesn't seem to exist in other generations. The same thing with the second term. The third term is mentioned by elders. The concept seems to be captured by elders, but not by middle-aged and young. So how do we handle those sorts of issues? Once you get to the conceptual stage, in ontology creations, you want to formalize them, and you use RDF. That's one easy way to do it, to create triples. It's subject-verb-object, basically. So you start to put it in a computational framework like OWL protégé, and you build it up on the road to computation. So we saw the relations, we saw the concepts, so now we've got something which is a part of something else. Something which feeds from something else. So that's that screenshot you saw early on as we build it up. And you get a sense here of how we're building up this ontology. It's connected to one of these concepts. It empties into, this particular thing empties into one of these concepts. It feeds from one of these concepts. It has something exactly. So you get a sense of how you start building this up computationally. So what we found when we were doing the logical ontology, or the formalization phase, was that the Cree had a very flat ontology. They didn't have a lot of classes. This derives from this, derives from this. As compared to the English, which had a much more hierarchical densely hierarchical ontology. We formalized the physiography first, the stuff that dealt with water and earth and materials and geology first. But even though we formalized the physiographic, so we left kind of the elder speakers, there was sacred relations amongst features that we found as well. But even for the physiographic stuff, formalizing an ontology is not so easy. We found that some streams were larger than other streams. But how do you make that computational? So you get all these little fuzzy categories where some are slightly larger, but how much is larger? But you need to have these precise distinctions when you're making it computational. So there is some information loss, even with the easy stuff. We actually went and we went back to the community several times, and well, we still go back to the community, and said, well, what do you think of the concepts that are put into classes at this stage, in the formalization stage? They said, yeah, that looks really great. Oh, they loved it, too, because this is one more way for knowledge preservation for them to have this concept map of how they view water systems. Getting them to elicit relationships, feeds from, empties into, that is very, very difficult and relies on a lot of cultural sensitivity that takes decades that at least we, when we went up there, we didn't have. So it's very easy for the Cree, well, for anyone who is confronted with odd ways of looking at their lives, right? It's like, why are you talking about relationships between banks and riverbeds? We don't think of the world that way. They came to the conclusion that English must be very ontological. Because how else? Why do you want to put things into boxes all the time? Well, they said, when we said, well, when we say empties into or feeds from, is that right? They'd say yes. So, I mean, it was always yes, 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 yes. So they had more qualifications for the concepts, but much less so for the relations. And this probably would be the case if we went to domain experts as well. Just to give you quickly some sense of what it turned into computationally, this is a geospatial issue for us. So what we did was when people would type in and zoom into a particular area, we'd start to highlight, portions of the map that was related to the ontology. And one of the things we tried as well is we linked places to stories. And so if you went to a particular place, you would get the story, but the related stories use the ontology as the backbone. So if a part of a river was related downstream to a stream or to a lake, we would connect those stories together. So we were drawing on the underlying ontology, this web of connections in the concept map, and we'd pull in the stories that were related. So I think I don't have time to talk about application number 2, which maybe Louise was hoping for. So
at least I know more about this one than the
project. That was a bit more computational, and that actually is, so I'm not going to spend much time talking about this other than to say that our goal here is to do cross-database queries of data. So a person can ask a single question, and the question is parsed into, okay, the first half of this question has to go to database number one. The second part of this question has to go to database two. The reason that I know the first part of this question has to go to database one is because the ontology tells me that's where the first part of this is going to be answered. And then it knows to go to these various ontologies. We actually used, three and a half. An upper-level ontology is a very high level of abstraction. A domain ontology, domains are domains of knowledge. Historian, ecologist, Islamic studies. Application ontology is the ontology that sits on the actual database itself and understands the relationships in the database. And the database schema and the application ontology talk to each other. And then, of course, sends it out. Okay, question part one goes to the Chinese biographical database. Oh, we found out that it now needs to go back into the Mingqing Women's Writers Database and get an answer from there. And it gets combined and then gets sent back to the user. And hopefully it's not a null set, which is one of the challenges of doing this, is that you can get a lot of, nope, no answer. So from a computational standpoint, hold on to yourselves, ontology at the upper level often look like this. So they often look incredibly abstract. We didn't invent this. A lot of this comes from places like the Dublin Core, other places that have metadata. So everything gets digested to events, places, bibliographic sources, or people, and you relate people by calling them friends of friends. And then you do things like have domain ontologies. Right? So just one interesting standpoint about the contestation amongst historians is apparently in Chinese literature you can have more than one biological mother. And I said, wow, you know, you could have, yes, you could, only one mother, right? But apparently, especially since the literature is written about people who had consorts and had stepmothers, could marry people, marry women after their wives left for some reason, maybe nefarious, maybe not. This woman in the literature would literally step in and become your biological mother. So yes, you have like seven different types of biological mothers. So there can be a lot of contestation in these fields. So I will skip these and then talk about, I think I'll talk about this, okay? One of the most interesting things to me about an ontology, in conclusion, is that it really shouldn't look upon it as something like metadata or the standard library catalog. It should often be looked at as a starting point, a conversation that requires collaboration. So you come together and you discuss the core concepts in your domain. It tends to require new skill sets. A lot of this is highly computational. But it could also require different ideas about how to do digital archiving. It may very well require a lot of new tools, for example, for searching multimedia or searching across languages, in addition to the OWLs and the RDFs that I alluded to. One question we have is which ontologies should have participation by domain experts, whether those domain experts are the owners of the database, the Chinese historians, the Cree who live in Wiminji. The reason that we ask this is sometimes the ontologies are incredibly abstract, So we like to think of these ontologies as a way to open up and make transparent ways that other cultures think about things. But you get some implication that they can be very abstract and thus opaque. So we may want people to participate in creating these, but sometimes they can be very, very difficult. It may have to be left to an IS person. Who creates and maintains the ontologies? Most of the stuff is funded by one-time grants. Most of the stuff is supposed to be housed in libraries, but librarians often don't have the time or the resources to maintain them. The American College of Learned Societies says that humanities professors should embrace ontologies, embrace new concepts like cyber infrastructures to join all these databases together. And they say, no one else is going to do it for us, so we have to do it. But my conversations with humanities people, I don't think these guys are ready yet. So the challenge is that you see the greatest development of ontologies in biology and engineering and Earth observation, but there's a crying need for ontology development in these softer sciences, but it's hard for them to get the skill set and the way of thinking about things to really do this. And for me, I'll end on this last point, is how do we maintain the contentiousness and the ambiguity in the data? We're going towards more and more standardization in our computation, but I think really interesting questions as we move to Web 3.0 is to maintain the vagueness in it and the richness in that vagueness and the redundancy and the contested definition. So that's going to be a grand challenge for us as we move to the semantic web, and also makes it really interesting to do research. So thank you very much, and I'd love to hear some questions if you have some.
In you applying this ontology to several databases in library collections, I wonder if this same kind of ontology can be applicable to archives. You know, archives have several records group, you say fonts, and in itself there are hierarchy. Fonts, we say records group and series, subseries and file and each item. And the library, the university archives collect all kind of administrative data.
Sure.
I hope to apply this one.
Well, I could just give you one example that may or may not answer your question. One of the first computational ontologies that was geography related was done with at the Canadian Geological Survey, that to handle legacy geology data. So our understanding of geology changes quite a bit over the decades. So what do you do with all that legacy data in which we have different concepts that have different attributes and different relations? So there's a person at the Canadian Geological Survey developed a model that allowed, kind of had a template, and the archivists and different professional geologists could snap their data to the template, and that allowed the archive data to talk to the new data and allowed professional geologists to talk to, say, Natural Resources Canada or the Geological Survey.
So the template that can be applicable to any kind of data set. That's what you're talking about.
Do you know if anybody's done any work on defining ontologies for Michigan University? I do. Right now I'm doing a lot of work with course and program data. And one of the things I discovered is that the word program means different things. So that seems to be a case for an ontology, not an issue.
Yeah. Most of my experience is with geographic data, so it's interesting that there's a couple of people doing research on the use of ontologies to describe computer models and decision support systems. So they have to do things like describe what a program is and get at the core concept. So get behind the dictionary word program to what does it actually mean. But I don't know who's doing computational ontology work here besides me. Probably bioinformatics is doing it. Hope you guys understood and I didn't leave you in the dust. Or at least I carried a lot of you most of the way.
And I think this may seem a little futuristic, but it's not. Web 3.0 is developing very rapidly.
Just with the promise of this all is, instead of doing a Google search and getting 3 million hits, you define things well and you get 2.
Exactly, and you might want to check out a guy named Wolfram Alpha. He's just announced a Web 3.0 search engine, which I think was available yesterday or on the 17th, I can't remember. So it's supposed to revolutionize the internet, but those of us who know realize that there's a lot of work that has to be done for the understanding, the underlying understanding to really work. Sorry, Louise.
Yes, I'm sorry. Are there any questions? Those
who have seen HTML and when you're putting tags in, I'm assuming the tags are one thing that allow and help in the searching. So what I'm wondering is there some kind of equivalent, what you would see as the equivalent mechanism in the 3.0 to tagging that you can begin to think about in documents that librarians may be handling? What would be the way that they would want to deal with these? So because if you're searching, you're trying to do the kind of work you do, is it so specialized we would always need to have fairly high level training to do it, or can some of it be done, as you were saying, put things could be for, we'd have sort of standard formats and then things could be put in for that, like you tag standard documents?
Here's the challenge with tags. People have actually formalized the tags, they call them folksonomies, so folk taxonomies. And obviously the folk can be less folky, and because it can be used officially as well. Tags tend to be, as you probably know already, they're very flat, they don't have a hierarchy in them, and you can have just minor variations in tags that don't allow any connections whatsoever. So New York City, all lowercase New York City, NYC, Gotham City. And they're all the same place, but they don't in Battery Park, right? So there are bits in it, right, that would, you could say, is part of New York City. So if you search for New York City, you should get it. They don't connect to each other. So that's why, and they don't have relations either. So one of the things that librarians are doing are looking for these controlled vocabularies. Another computational way to do it is people are looking at tag clouds, right, at the coincidence of these tags. So you see, and there's little applications out there that allow you to create tag clouds that, you know, vary. You see them. They're like just words, line after line, and some are big fonts and some are little fonts. And you will often see the like concepts clustering close to each other. So there's a user-generated way of getting at it from the back end after all the data is created. And that's probably what librarians are going to have to do, because the horse is out of the gate with this one. We can't all go back to the Dublin Core. As you know, the Dublin Core had its faults, too, because it's not as standardized as we may want it, but it is at least something that gives us core keywords, right? Author, publisher. So that's probably what's going to happen with tags. But I think tags is one way to do it. It's just, you know, who's going to get there to standardize the tags.
Okay, are there any questions from the crowd out there in TV land? Any other questions? That was a wonderful, fascinating presentation, and I certainly learned a lot. I didn't realize how computational ontologies could be used in a very human way, instead of having technology force human beings to think in very standard ways. This is a technology that actually embraces, as you said, controversial concepts, and I think there's hope for the future.
I hope so.
I thought that was very, very interesting. Thank you so much, and thank you for coming. I forgot to pass around the membership list, but I think we'll just hold it for now. And
does anyone want to add themselves?
Anyone want to add? Yes. Yeah. But, we'll be redoing the website as well. It does need some revamp. But so please watch our website. We'll be starting again next week.